He grabbed a handful of snow and wiped off his mouth, torn between hunger and sickness, though he knew he couldn't have swallowed much because the corpse had been frozen through. He walked away, as quickly as he could manage, without running.
Anna?
Charles finished zipping together the sleeping bags. She didn't answer him. She'd shed her coat and boots, then climbed back on the rock. She stood barefoot, her wool socks in one hand. If they'd been somewhere else, he'd have believed that she was enjoying the view. But they were tucked in the trees, where all she could see was more trees. She wasn't so much looking out as not looking at the sleeping bags and him. As soon as they'd finished eating, she'd started shutting down again. The temperature had dropped 10 degrees when the sun went down, and it was too bloody cold for her to be standing around barefoot and coatless. Werewolf she might be, but frostbite still hurt like sin. But he wasn't going to get her into the bags without force or coaxing. He took his own boots off and stuck the socks into his pack. He took out 2 fresh pairs of socks and stuck them in the bottom of the sleeping bag so they'd be warm tomorrow morning. He'd packed an extra blanket, which he shook out and wrapped around his shoulders. Then he walked over and hopped up on the rock next to her. There wasn't a lot of room, but he managed to stand shoulder to shoulder with her.
"My cousins quartered their women with blankets," he told her without looking at her.
She didn't say anything, just pulled her toes up and curled them together for warmth.
"It's called a snagging blanket," he said. "One of them would go up to the girl he was courting and slowly stretch an arm out."
He held on to the corner of the blanket and put his arm around her shoulders.
"And he wrapped the blanket over her. If she didn't duck away, he'd snag her close."
He tugged, and she took a step sideways until she was tucked under his arm with the blanket snug around them both. "A snagging blanket?" There was amusement in her voice, but her body was still stiff. Wolf, he thought, but not completely. If he hadn't been looking for it, he might not have smelled the distinctive scent of her wolf intermingled with the perfume that was Anna.
"My brother Samuel is even smoother with it than I am," he told her,
moving a little more until she stood in front of him, her cold feet on top of his. She inhaled and let the air out in one long, frosty breath, her body softening against him. "Tell me about mating," she said. He tightened his arms around her.
"I'm kind of a novice at it myself."
"You've never been mated before?"
"No."
He breathed in her scent and let it sink into him and warm his chest.
"I told you some of it. Mostly courting is just like it is with humans. Then they marry, and eventually, usually, his wolf accepts her as his mate."
"What if it never does?"
"Then it doesn't."
He wasn't nearly so sanguine as he sounded.
"I had all but given up finding a mate when I met you."
He couldn't help his smile as he thought of the bewildered joy of that first meeting.
"Brother Wolf chose you as my mate the moment he laid eyes on you. And I can only applaud his good sense."
"What would have happened if you had hated me?" He sighed against her hair.
"Then we'd not be here. I wouldn't want to end up like my father and Leah."
"He hates her?" He shrugged.
"No, not really. I don't know."
How had they ended up on this subject?
"He'd never say anything one way or another, but matters are not right between them. He told me once a long time ago that his wolf decided that he needed a mate to replace my mother."
"So what went wrong?" she asked, as her body softened into his. He shook his head.
"I have no desire to ask the Merrock that question, and suggest you don't either."
She thought of something else. "You said something about a full moon ceremony?"
"Right," he said. "There's a ceremony held under the moon to sanctify our bond. Like a marriage ceremony, I suppose, though it's private. You'll also be brought fully into my father's pack, then."
He felt her stiffen, the pack ceremony, which included the sharing of the Alpha's flesh and blood, literally, could be pretty frightening if you weren't ready for it. And why would Leo have done that right when he'd done so much else wrong? He decided it was something they could discuss when he wasn't trying to get her to relax and come crawl into sleeping bags with him.
If you choose, we could do a separate marriage in the church if you'd like. Invite your family.
She twisted so she could see his face. How can you tell that we aren't bonded?
It's almost like pack magic, he told her. Some wolves can barely feel it. Pack magic is what allows an alpha to draw on his wolves to give himself an edge in speed or quicker healing. It lets him control wolves under his power, or find them if he needs to.
Anna stilled. Or feed off their rage? I think Isabella did that. She liked it when the pack fought among themselves.
Yes, Charles agreed. Though I've never seen my father do that. But you know what I mean?
Yes, mating is like that.
On a smaller scale. It varies between couples. Sometimes it's just being able to tell where your mate is. My Da says that's all he and Leah have. Sometimes it's more than that. One of the wolves in Oklahoma is mated to a blind woman. She can see now, as long as she's in the same room with him. More common are things like being able to share strength, or any of the other things an alpha can get from his pack.
He fell silent and waited for another question.
My toes are cold, he suggested after a bit.
Sorry, she said, and he rubbed her cheek with his thumb. Touch was something he usually avoided. Touch allowed the others to get too close to him, a closeness he couldn't afford if he was to survive his job as his father's pet killer. It made Brother Wolf all the hungrier for it. With Anna, he let go of his usual rules. There were reasons. She was his mate, and even for his father, he wouldn't harm her. She was Omega and unlikely to go rogue, but the real reason, he admitted to himself, was that he could not resist the feel of her skin against his own.
Rome wasn't built in a day, he told her. Come sleep.
And then, when she stiffened against him, he said,
It's too cold to do anything more interesting.
She stilled. That was a lie, wasn't it? He buried his cold nose against her neck, startling a small laugh out of her.
You're getting better. What if I said you're too tired, then?
He stepped out of the blanket and wrapped it around her shoulders. Then he picked her up and jumped off the rock, bending his knees to make the landing gentler. He'd forgotten his wounds. As he carried her over to the sleeping bags, his injured calf ached fiercely. He ignored the sizzling pain. His chest wasn't happy with him either, but when she settled into the sleeping bags with him, it would have taken a lot more than a couple of bullet holes to make him unhappy. She was asleep long before he was.
They stopped by Bari Lake, but the only sign anyone had been nearby was a pair of snowmobile tracks across the frozen water. It was wilderness, but it was also Montana. Snowmobiles didn't bother him as much as the dirt bikers, because the snowmobiles didn't damage the land. He'd run into a couple dirt bikers here a couple of years ago and had followed them to Wanless Lake, about 20 miles from the nearest road, where they had finally parked their bikes and gone swimming. He wondered how long it had taken them to get their machines back down without the spark plugs. There was no easy way to get from Baree to the Bear Lakes in the winter. He and Tag had mapped out something that appeared to be a passable route, but if it got too rugged, he'd find a different way. All he wanted was for the rogue to see them and go hunting. He thought about those snowmobile tracks, though. Most of the cabinets were too rough for snowmobiles. If you only wanted to go to Bari Lake and back, though, say to find a few victims and get some news coverage for a werewolf kill, they'd be fine. An organized pack of renegades, determined to force Bran not to reveal the existence of werewolves to the real world, would require different treatment than a single rogue. He would keep the snowmobiles in mind and be ready to face multiple opponents if necessary. Anna was a restful companion.
She was clearly enjoying herself, despite being a little stiff this morning. She didn't complain as their trails grew rougher, requiring a lot more muscle. She was mostly quiet, which let him listen for other monsters in the woods. Since he tended to be quiet at times, he was glad that she didn't chatter. She'd woken up cheerful and relaxed, and stayed that way, until they dropped into a small hanging valley. He could measure her growing nervousness by the slow shrinking of the distance between them. When she finally spoke, she was near enough that she accidentally stepped on the back of his snowshoe with hers. "Sorry." The resultant stumble hurt his wounded leg, but he'd never have told her that.
"No problem, are you all right?"
He saw her consider a polite lie and discard it. "It's kind of creepy here," she said finally. Charles agreed with her. There were a number of places in the cabinets that felt like this. He couldn't be sure, but this felt worse than usual. It was certainly worse than the part of the mountains they'd crossed yesterday. Her observation made him give a thorough look around them, in case she'd noticed something he hadn't. But there was nothing to be seen, nothing more threatening than the cliff face that rose above them and cast its shadow over the valley, and the thick growth of green-black trees on all sides. But he didn't discount other forces at work. The spirits of these mountains had never been welcoming, not like the Bitterroots or Pintlers. They resented intruders. It might be that the spirits were just more active in this valley, or something could have happened. The more he thought about it, the more certain he was that it was more than just spirits making mischief. From last week, or 100 years ago, he couldn't tell, but something dark lingered beneath the snow.
"You're a werewolf," he told her. "Creepy shouldn't bother you."
She snorted. "I was never afraid of monsters until I became one. Now I'm afraid of my own shadow." He heard the self-directed derision and snorted right back at her.
"Baloney, I..."
He caught a wild scent and stopped, turning his nose into the wind to catch it again. Anna froze, watching him. He waited until the scent got a little stronger. Their stalker was not worried that they would notice him.
"What do you smell?"
he asked her softly. She sucked in a deep breath and closed her eyes. "Trees? And whoever you stole these clothes from, and..." She stiffened as she caught what he had. "Cat? Some kind of cat. Is it a panther?"
"Close," he told her. "Lynx, I think. Nasty-tempered, but not a danger to us."
"Cool," she said. "What a..." This time it was her turn to pause. "What's that?"
"Dead rabbit," he said, pleased. "You're starting to pay attention to your nose."
He took another breath and reconsidered.
"It might be a mouse, but probably a rabbit. That's why the lynx is still around. We've interrupted his dinner."
He was a little surprised that they'd run into a lynx here. Cats usually stayed away from places that felt like this. Could it have been driven here by bigger predators? She looked a little green. "I really hate it that part of me is getting hungry smelling raw meat." It hadn't bothered her to smell Jack's blood, but he hadn't fed her in an hour, and she was hungry. Her body was burning up calories to stay warm, but hungry or not, it wasn't the time to feed her a real meal. He needed to get out of this little draw. So he handed her a bag of peanut butter crackers and got them going again. The peanut butter would make sure she started drinking out of her canteen. He wasn't sure she'd been drinking enough. They hiked until the valley was behind them, and the dark feeling stayed behind too, confirming his guess that it wasn't spirits.
"Lunchtime,"
he said, handing her a granola bar and a stick of jerky. She took them, brushed most of the snow off of a down tree, then hopped up on it. "I was fine until we hit that valley. Now I'm bushed and frozen, and it's only 1 o'clock. How do humans do this?" He sat beside her, eating his own jerky. It tasted a lot better than pemmican, though it wasn't nearly as strengthening without all the fat.
"Most of them don't. Not this time of year. I pushed us a little hard to get out of that valley. That's what you're feeling."
He frowned.
"You haven't been sweating, have you? Are your socks dry? I brought spares. Wet socks mean frostbite. You could lose a toe."
She wiggled her snowshoes, which dangled a foot or so off the ground.
I thought being a werewolf meant indestructible, short of death. Something in her face told him she was thinking about the beatings she'd been given to try to make her into something she was not.
It might grow back, Charles said,
soothing Brother Wolf, who didn't like it when Anna was unhappy.
But it wouldn't be fun.
Cool. Then, as an afterthought, she told him, my socks are dry.
Let me know if that changes.
The snowshoes were dragging at her feet. She gave Charles a mock resentful glare. It was safe because she was glaring at his back. Bullet holes and all, he was obviously not having any trouble. He was barely limping as they scaled the side of another mountain. He'd slowed down, but that didn't help as much as she'd hoped. If he hadn't promised her an early camp at the top of the current climb, she probably would have just collapsed where she stood.
Not far, he said, without looking around.
Doubtless her panting told him all he needed to know about how tired she was.
Part of it is the altitude, he told her. You're used to more oxygen in the air and have to breathe harder to make up the difference.
He was making excuses for her, and it stiffened her spine. She'd make this climb if it killed her. She dug the edge of her snowshoe into the snow in preparation for the next step, and a wild cry echoed through the trees, raising the hair on the back of her neck as it echoed off the mountains. What's that? She asked. Charles gave her a grim smile over his shoulder.
Werewolf.
Can you tell where it came from?
East of here, he said. The way sound carries out here is a few miles away.
She shivered a little, though she shouldn't be afraid. After all, she was a werewolf too, right? And she'd seen Charles wipe the floor with her former alpha, despite having been shot several times.
He won't hurt you, Charles said.
She didn't say anything, but he was watching her face, and his eyes softened.
If you really don't like me using my nose to tell what you're feeling, you can try using perfume. It works a treat.
She sniffed and smelled only the people who had loaned Charles their clothing. You don't use perfume. He grinned, his teeth white in his dark face.
Too sissy for me. I hadn't learned to control my emotions instead.
Then he removed whatever starch she had left in her knees when he added a little ruefully,
until I met you.
He started up the mountainside again, leaving her scrambling behind him. Who was she that she could touch this man? Why her? Was it just that she was an Omega? Somehow she didn't think so. Not with that wry admission hanging in the air. He was hers. Just to be certain, she counted on her gloved fingers. This time last week, she'd been waiting tables at Scorchy's, had never heard of Charles, or walked a mile in snowshoes. Would never have dreamed of enjoying kissing a man ever again. Now she was tramping through the snow and below zero weather with a silly smile on her face, hunting a werewolf. Or, at least, following Charles, who was hunting a werewolf. Weird. And kinda nice. And there were fringe benefits to following Charles around. The view, for one.
Are you giggling?
Charles said, in his Mr. Spock voice. He looked back at her, then executed one of those complicated turns that snowshoes required in order to reverse directions. He pulled off a glove and touched her nose, right where she knew freckles gathered. His fingers drifted down to trace the dimple in her left cheek.
I like seeing you happy, he said intently.
His perusal stopped her laughter, but not the warm, fuzzy feeling in her stomach. Yeah? She said archly. Then tell me that was really the last climb, and that this big, flat spot we're standing on is where we're gonna camp, and then I don't have to walk anymore today. She stood there looking like a cat in the cream, and he had not the foggiest notion why. He wasn't used to this. He was good at reading people, dammit. He had lots of practice, and Brother Wolf was all but empathetic sometimes. And he still had no clue why she stood there looking at him with secret laughter still dancing in her eyes. He bent until he could press his forehead against her wool hat and closed his eyes, breathing her in and letting the warmth of her spread over his heart. Her scent broke free of the bindings he'd set upon it and rushed over him like the smoke of a hookah.
No more human scent for them, but absorbed in her. He couldn't make himself mind. He still should have heard it, smelled it, something. One moment he was standing next to Anna, the next he was face down in the snow with something, werewolf, his tardy nose informed him, on his back, and Anna underneath. Teeth dug into the tough fabric of his jacket and ripped at his pack. He ignored the werewolf for Anna's sake and pushed himself and the other werewolf up to give her room to get out from under him, knowing it was probably a fatal decision. Anna wriggled out from underneath him as fast as any sleight-of-hand magician's assistant could have, but she didn't listen to his order to run. The attacking wolf didn't seem to notice her. It was so busy ripping up Charles's backpack, it wasn't paying attention to anything else. Rogue, Charles thought. Out of control, if it was so far gone, not to release its first hold for something more immediately fatal. Not that he was complaining. Charles's human form was a little more fragile than the wolf, but it was almost as strong. Without Anna beneath him, it took him a bare instant to rip the bindings on his snowshoes apart to free his feet. Silver foil packets dropped on both sides of him like confetti thrown at a wedding. Freeze-dried meals. Doubtless Samuel would have come up with something funny about that.
Let's just see who ends up a frozen dinner.
Grunting with the effort, Charles straightened his legs with as much speed and power as he could gather, and the move, combined with the werewolf's weight, ripped the fabric of Charles's coat and backpack. Holding on to the fabric and nothing else, the wolf was thrown off his back. A kick, and the wolf was 10 feet away. Not far enough, and yet too far. He was between Charles and Anna, and he was closer to Anna. Even as Charles frantically freed himself of the remnants of the pack, ruthlessly shredding anything that tried to stick, he realized how weird the attack was. Even an out-of-control rogue wouldn't have been entirely foiled by the pack. He'd have gotten a fang or claw in somewhere. But Charles was entirely unharmed. The wolf had rolled to his feet but made no further move to attack. He was scared, that wolf. The scent of his fear flooded the air as he met Charles's eyes defiantly. But he stayed where he was, between Charles and Anna, as if he were protecting her. Charles narrowed his eyes and tried to place this wolf. He'd met so many. Gray on gray was not an uncommon coloring, though he was even thinner than Anna's wolf form, cadaverously thin. He didn't smell familiar, nor did he smell of a pack. He smelled as if he'd denned in Douglas fir, cedar, and granite, as if he'd never been touched by shampoo or soap or any of the accoutrements of modern life.
"Who are you?" Charles asked.
"Who are you?" repeated Anna, and the wolf looked at her.
Hell afire, so did Charles. When she used it, she could pull in any wolf she wanted almost as effectively as Bran, though he'd have done it by sheer force of personality. Anna made you want to curl up at her feet and bask in her peace. Charles saw the moment when the wolf realized that there were no humans here to protect at all. He smelled the other wolf's anger and hatred as it flared, then vanished as it came up against his Anna, leaving bewilderment behind. The wolf ran.
"Are you all right?"
asked Charles, ridding himself of his clothes as rapidly as possible. He could have used magic to strip, as he usually did, but he didn't want to risk using it here, when he might need it for something more important later. The damned bandage around his ribs was tough, and it hurt when he shredded it with his fingernails as they lengthened. A bit of his snowshoe binding had tangled with a bootlace, so he broke the lace.
"I'm fine."
"Stay here,"
he ordered, as he let Brother Wolf flow over him and rob him of speech. He shuddered as the shape brought with it the call of the hunt, and every minute the change took let the other get farther away.
"I'll be here," she told him,
and as his wolf shape settled over him and solidified, more words flowed over him.
"Don't hurt him."
He nodded before he disappeared into the woods. He wasn't going to have to kill anyone this trip. With Anna's help, he was going to bring that rogue into safety. As soon as he left, Anna found herself shivering
as if someone had just removed her coat and left her bare to the ice and snow. She glanced around nervously, wondering why the shadows of the trees seemed suddenly deeper. The firs, which only moments ago had been just trees, now seemed to loom over her in silent menace.
"I'm a monster, damn it,"
she said aloud. As if in answer, the wind died, and silence descended. A heavy, blanketing silence that seemed somehow alive, though nothing moved or made a noise. Even the little birds, chickadees and nuthatches, were quiet. She glared at the trees, and that helped a little, but the feeling that something was watching her kept growing. Her nose told her there was nothing, but it hadn't told her about the wolf that had knocked her and Charles off their feet, either. Now that the wolf had skedaddled, her alarm system was in full swing. How useful. But thinking about the wolf reminded her of that odd feeling she'd had just a few moments ago, as if she could see through the strange werewolf's skin and into his soul, feel his torment, his need. She'd stretched out her hand and asked him who he was, part of her certain that he would come to her and answer. When he'd run instead, it had torn her from the strange awareness. She couldn't put her finger on most of what she'd sensed from the wolf. She felt like a blind man seeing colors for the first time, but she would swear that he'd attacked to protect her, and that he'd done his best not to hurt Charles. Something watched her. She sniffed, taking in the scent of the air, but smelled only the usual woodland scents. She walked the perimeter of the clearing, but detected nothing with her eyes, ears, or nose. She walked it again anyway, with the same results. Looking a third time wasn't going to help matters. She needed to calm down, or she was going to go chasing after Charles in full panic. Yeah, that would impress him a whole lot. Not that she'd ever done anything that might impress him. She folded her arms over her stomach, which had started to ache with some emotion she couldn't name, wouldn't name. It might have been rage. For 3 years, she'd endured because, as bad as it was, she needed the pack. They were a visceral requirement her wolf could not do without. So she'd let them rob her of her pride. Let Leo take control of her body and pass her around like a whore that he owned. For a moment, she could smell Justin's breath in her face, feel his body holding hers down, the ache in her wrists, and the pressure on her nose where he'd broken it with a carefully controlled, open-handed blow. Blood dripped down her lip and down her new coat to splatter in the snow. Startled, she put her hand to her nose, but there was nothing wrong with it, though a moment ago she'd felt it swelling as it had the night Justin hit it. But the blood was still there. She bent down and took a handful of snow and pressed it against her nose until it burned uncomfortably. She put her hand to her nose and it came away clean this time, so it wasn't still bleeding. The question was, why had it started bleeding in the first place? And why had she suddenly started thinking about Justin? Maybe the nosebleed had something to do with the altitude, she thought. Charles would know. She got clean snow and wiped her face with that, then a scrap of backpack that was nearby. She touched her nose and her fingers came away clean. Whatever the cause, it had stopped. She scrubbed at the bloodstains on her jacket and succeeded only in smearing the blood around. With a sigh, she looked for somewhere to put the bloody piece of fabric. She'd taken off her pack when she'd done her earlier reconnoitering. It sat in unharmed glory amidst foil-covered meals scattered in fanciful patterns with bits and pieces of Charles's backpack. Typical man, she thought, with experimental exasperation, leaving the woman to clean up the mess. She gathered Charles's clothes and shook them free of snow. She stuffed them into her pack and then started putting the foil-clad meals on top. With a little organization, she was able to put most of the undamaged food in her backpack, but there was no way she would be able to stuff anything more into it. She gave the remains of Charles's backpack, sleeping bag, and snowshoes a frustrated look. It wouldn't have bothered her so much, except this was a wilderness area and they weren't supposed to leave anything behind. She looked closely at Charles's backpack, but it had been ripped to shreds. The gun had taken damage, too. She didn't know much about rifles, but she suspected that they needed a straight barrel to work right. She hit the jackpot, though, when one of the pieces of backpack turned out to be the ground cloth they'd slept on last night. She smelled something as she knelt to spread the tough fabric out. She tried not to react to the scent, collecting all the leftover bits and throwing them in the center of the cloth. Everything except the gun. Even though it was bent, it was still reassuringly solid. Whoever it was stayed very still, watching her. A human, not a werewolf. Tied together, the cloth made a tidy bundle that they could carry out. As Anna moved the makeshift pack next to her backpack, she heard her watcher move out of the trees behind her. "Looks like you had a mess on your hands," said a friendly voice. "Did you run into a bear?" She sounded friendly enough. Anna turned to look at the woman who'd come out of the trees after watching her for too long to be entirely trustworthy. Like Anna, she was wearing snowshoes, but she had ski poles in each of her hands. Deep brown eyes peered out from under her hat, but the rest of her face was covered in a woolen scarf. Underneath her gray hat, dark brown curls fell to her shoulders. Anna took a deep breath, but all her nose told her was that the woman was human. Would a human's hearing be poor enough that all the noise of the fight might have been made by a bear rather than a pair of werewolves? Darned if she knew. "A bear, yes," Anna gave her a smile she hoped would cover up the amount of time it had taken her to reply. "Sorry, I'm still a little off. I'm a city girl and I'm not used to Mother Nature in all her glory. Yes, a bear. We scared it off, then discovered it had one of our..." What would they need so badly that a human man would have to go chasing after a bear? Small packs, the one with the lighter in it. The other woman threw back her head and laughed. "Isn't that the way it always works? I'm Mary Alvarado. What are you doing out here in the middle of winter if you're not used to the wild country?" "I'm Anna Cornick." Somehow it seemed right to use Charles's name. Anna gave Mary Alvarado another wry smile. "We haven't been married long. I'm not used to a new last name. You must be out looking for the hunter, too. We were told that no one else was going to be this far out. I may be green as grass, but my husband knows his way around."
"Search and rescue, that's me," said Mary.
"Isn't everyone supposed to go by twos?" Anna asked. She wasn't sure about it, but it only seemed sensible. Heather and Jack had been hunting together. Mary shrugged.
"I have a partner around here somewhere. We had an argument and she took off in a huff, but she'll get over it soon and let me catch up."
She grinned conspiratorially. "She's pretty hot-tempered." The woman took a step closer to Anna, but then stopped abruptly and looked around. Anna felt it too, like a great wind of evil flowing through the trees. Something growled. Chapter 9. In his hothouse, a seal trimmed dead blooms from his roses. They weren't as glorious as the ones he'd had in Spain, but they were a vast improvement over the commercially grown flowers he'd started with. His Spanish roses had been the result of centuries of careful breeding. It hadn't bothered him to leave them at the time, but now he regretted their loss fiercely. Not as fiercely as he regretted losing Sarai. He hoped that someone had taken them over, but the state he'd left his property in almost ensured his flowers had died before anyone figured out what to do with the estate. Still, he'd been exchanging cuttings and rootstock with other rose aficionados for several decades before he'd been forced to leave, so his work had not all been in vain. Somewhere in the world, there were probably descendants of his roses. Maybe if Bran made him live a few more years, he'd go out looking for them. Someone knocked briskly at the inner door, then opened it without waiting for a reply. He didn't even bother looking up. Sage had been invading his hothouse almost since he'd built it. He would have long ago reduced anyone else to shreds for interrupting his solitude. Slapping down Sage was as rewarding as beating a puppy. It accomplished nothing except to make him feel abusive. "Hello? Hello?" she called out, though her nose certainly told her exactly where he was. It was her usual greeting. He thought that it was to make sure that he wasn't feeling homicidally reclusive that day. He'd had a few of those right after he'd come to Aspen Creek. When she first started showing up, he'd wondered if the Merrick wasn't sending her to make sure he was still sane enough to leave alive. If so, it had been only prudent, and he'd long since quit caring one way or the other.
"I'm here," he told her, not bothering to raise his voice. She'd hear him if he whispered, and he was finished pretending to be human. He didn't look up from his work when she walked up behind him. His standards of beauty had broadened over the years, but even if they hadn't, Sage would have hit every chime he had. Sarai had often thumped him soundly on the head for looking at other women, though she'd known he'd never stray. Now that she was gone, he seldom even looked. Flirting didn't make him feel disloyal to his dead mate, but he'd found he missed that thump too badly. Of course, given the opportunity to irritate the so composed Charles, he had happily dealt with his memories.
"Hey, Seal. You're smiling. Someone die?"
She obviously didn't expect him to answer that, but continued, "You have something I can do?"
"I'm deadheading," he told her, though she could see that for herself. Sometimes he was so impatient with all of it, meaningless conversations that mimicked ones he'd had 1,000,000 times. Just as he got tired of people who had to work out the same issues over and over. He wondered how Bran kept his air of bemused interest at his people's petty problems. "Still," thought Asil, with a thread of self-directed, bitter amusement, "I must not be so tired of life, because I grabbed at the ring when Bran offered the chance at it, didn't I?" Sage ignored his shortness with relentless cheer. It was one of the things he liked about her, that he didn't have to constantly apologize for his volatile mood swings. She took off her coat and settled in just to his right to start on the next row of bushes. So he knew she was in the mood for a good talk. Otherwise, she'd have started on the other side of the bushes, where she wouldn't get in the way of his work.
"So what do you think of Charlie's mate?" she asked.
He grunted. It had been wicked of him to tease Bran's boy, but he had been unable to resist. It wasn't often Charles was off balance. And Anna reminded him so much of his own Sarai. Not in looks. Sarai had been almost as dark as he was. But they both had the same inner serenity.
"Well, I like her," Sage said. "She has more backbone than you'd think, given the way her old alpha abused her."
That shocked him.
"Abuse and Omega?"
She nodded. "For years. I guess Leo was a real piece of work. Killed off half his pack or let his crazy mate do it. He even ordered one of his wolves to force the change on Anna. What I don't understand is why Charles didn't slaughter the whole pack. None of them did anything to protect her. How hard is it to pick up the phone and call Bran?"
"If Leo ordered them not to, they wouldn't be able to call," Asil said absently. He'd known Leo, the Chicago Alpha, and liked him, too. Not unless they were nearly as dominant as Leo, which is unlikely.
Leo had been a strong Alpha, and, he would have sworn, an honorable man. Perhaps Sage was mistaken. Asil clipped a few brown-edged roses, then asked,
"Do you know why Leo did these things?"
She looked up from her own task.
"I guess his mate was going age crazy.
She killed all the females in the pack out of jealousy, then went out and turned a bunch of good-looking men just for fun. Apparently Leo hoped that having an Omega like Anna in the pack would keep his mate stable. It worked, more or less. He had Anna brutalized, though, to keep her under his thumb."
Asil paused.
a cold chill running down his back. When speaking of an unmated female in a pack, brutalized was a terrible word, much worse than abused. This modern era's definition of abuse was different than the one he'd grown up with. Brutalized hadn't changed a bit.
"Brutalized how?"
he asked hoarsely, suddenly remembering the rare rage he'd left Charles in when he'd brought Anna flowers. He had a brief image of a glimpse he'd had of Anna over Charles's shoulder. Had she been frightened? Damn his penchant for causing trouble. What had he done? Sage dug her fingers into the dirt, doubtless reliving her own brutal assault, which had resulted in her seeking sanctuary here in Aspen Creek a few years before he had come here. He should apologize for bringing that up, too. Clumsy, clumsy, Asil. "What do you think they did to her?" she said finally, darkness clinging to her voice.
"Allah," he said softly.
He'd never managed to get Charles so worked up before, and he'd left that poor child to deal with the results, thinking that any Omega could soothe her mate. He hadn't realized she'd already been hurt before. Truly, he should have forced Bran to kill him a long time ago.
"What's wrong?"
"I need to go talk to Charles," he said, setting down his knife and getting to his feet.
He was getting old and complacent, too ready to believe he was omniscient. He thought the boy had been waiting until his wounds were healed before consummating their attachment. Instead, he'd almost certainly been trying to give the girl time. That Charles had come this morning to ask about Omegas might mean that something had gone wrong. And on the heels of that thought, he realized that Charles hadn't been asking about Sarai when he asked what happened if an Omega was tortured. He'd been asking about Anna.
"Talking with Charles is going to be difficult," Sage said dryly. "He took Anna and went after some rogue over in the cabinets. There's no cell phone reception out there."
"The cabinets?"
He frowned at her, remembering the limp Charles had been hiding in church yesterday. He'd been doing a better job this morning, but Asil could still see he was stiff.
"He was wounded."
She nodded. "I heard he got shot in Chicago. Silver bullets. But there's some rogue werewolf running around attacking people. Killed one and wounded another in less than a week. Heather Morrill's partner was the one wounded. If we're going to keep it out of the news, the rogue has to be taken out as soon as possible so he doesn't hurt anyone else. And who else does Bran have to send after him? Samuel's not suitable, even if he hadn't just headed back to Washington this morning. Word is that Bran's worried it might be a ploy on the part of the European wolves to see if they can cause enough trouble that Bran reconsiders going public. So he needs a dominant wolf."
How Sage knew so much about everything that went on in the Merrok's pack had ceased to astound Asil a long time ago.
"He could have sent me," said Asil,
not really paying attention to his own words. It was good news if Anna had gone with Charles, wasn't it? Surely it meant he hadn't done any permanent harm to her with his teasing. Sage looked at him.
"Send you? Could he really? I saw you at church yesterday morning."
"He could have sent me," Asil repeated.
Sage, he knew, was beginning to suspect that his madness was feigned. Bran probably thought so too, since he hadn't just killed him, though Asil had requested it of him repeatedly. 15 years of not yet. It was too bad that both Sage and Bran were wrong. His madness was a more subtle thing, and it might kill them all in the end. Asil was a danger to everyone around him, and if he weren't such a coward, he'd have made Bran take care of the problem when he'd first arrived here, or any day since then. He could have at least taken out the lone rogue wolf. He owed Bran that much.
"I don't think Charles was hurt too badly," she said in conciliatory tones.
So Charles had been successful at hiding his wounds from Sage, but he knew better. It would take a lot to make that old Lobo move so badly at the funeral, where so many could see. Asil took a deep breath. Charles was tough, and he knew the cabinets better than anyone. Even wounded, a single rogue wolf would be no match for him. It was all right. He'd just make sure and apologize to both of them when he saw them next, and hope he hadn't caused any irreparable damage with his goading. He'd just been so jealous. The peace that Anna brought him had made him remember. "Ah," said I, "you'd be so disappointed in me."
"Are you all right?"
He knelt again and picked up his shears.
"I'm fine."
But why would the Europeans send only one wolf?
Maybe they hadn't. Maybe Charles would need backup.
He sighed. He owed the boy an apology that shouldn't wait. If he knew where they had started, he could track Charles down and make sure he hadn't done any real damage to the bond between him and his mate.
"I need to talk to Bran," he said.
He threw down the shears again and strode out the door, closing the greenhouse door behind him. When he exited the airlock, the cold fell over him like the cloak of the Ice Queen. The contrast between it and the artificially warm and moist air of his greenhouse was so great, he gasped once before his lungs made the adjustment. Sage followed him, pulling on her coat, but he didn't wait for her. "I don't know that it is the Europeans," Bran told him calmly, after Asiel expressed his opinion of the wisdom of sending Charles out wounded after an unknown foe, in words that were less than diplomatic. "More likely it is simply a rogue. The cabinets are remote and might appeal to someone trying to run from what he has become. Even if it were the Europeans, there was only one wolf. If there were two wolves, Heather wouldn't have been able to drive off the one who attacked them." He paused, but Asiel just crossed his arms over his chest and let him know by body language that he still thought Bran had been stupid. Bran smiled and put his feet up on his desk. "I didn't send Charles alone. Even if there are two or three werewolves, Charles and Anna between them should manage. More than two or three, I would have sensed when they came so close to Aspen Creek." That made sense. So why was dread growing in his soul? Why was every instinct he had telling him that sending Charles out after this rogue was such a stupid thing? And when had he stopped worrying about Charles and started worrying about what they chased? About the werewolf they chased? "What did the wolf look like?" He rocked slowly from one foot to the other, but didn't bother controlling himself. He was too busy thinking. "Like a German shepherd," Bran said. "Tan with dark points and the saddle, with a bit of white around his front feet. Both the grad student who escaped it and Heather described it the same way." The door to Bran's study opened, and Sage burst in. "Did... I see he's made it here."
"What's wrong?"
"Nothing," said Bran gently. "Asiel, go home. I want you to rest today at home. I'll let you know as soon as I hear something." Asiel stumbled by Sage, no longer worried about Charles at all. That coloration might be common in Alsatians, German shepherds, but it was not seen much in werewolves. Sarai had looked like that. Tan and dark brown, with a saddle-shaped dark patch of fur on her back. Her left front paw had been white. Too upset to be careful of his strength, he broke the door handle of his car and had to slide in from the passenger side. He didn't remember the drive to his house, just a need to go hide that was even more powerful than the necessity of obeying his alpha. He didn't bother garaging his car, for tonight it could face the elements, just as he must. He went to his bedroom and opened his closet. He took her favorite shirt, frayed by age and handling, from the hanger. Even to his nose, it no longer smelled like Sarai, but it had touched her flesh, and that was all he had. He put it on his pillow and slid onto the bed, rubbing his cheek against her shirt. It had happened at last, he thought. He was crazy. It could not possibly be his Sarai. First, she would never kill anyone without cause. Second, she was dead. He'd found her himself, days after she died. He'd taken her poor body and washed it clean, had burned it with salt and holy water. Knowing who had killed her, he wanted there to be no way to raise her from the dead, though neither Mariposa's family nor the witch they'd sent her to for training were of the family of witches who played with the dead. No, it wasn't Sarai. His stomach hurt, his throat hurt, and his eyes burned with tears, and with the old rage that curdled his blood. He should have killed the witch, but had been forced to run instead. Run while his wife's killer lived. Because he was afraid of what Mariposa had become. Afraid of the witch who hunted him, as she'd hunted his Sarai. Only when he could stand running no longer, when it was apparent that time was not going to kill her as it ought, he'd come here, to die and join his beloved at last. But he let the Merrock, and later his roses, persuade him to wait. And she hadn't found him here. Maybe she'd quit looking at last, having grown more powerful with each year until she didn't need him. Maybe the Merrock's power protected him as it protected the rest of the pack. As he lay, panting on his bed, the conviction grew that the time had come for his death. He folded the shirt lovingly where it was and strode back to his front door. He would persuade Bran this time. But he couldn't open the door. Couldn't force his hand to touch the doorknob. He roared his anger, but that changed nothing. He could not disobey Bran. He'd been so distressed that he hadn't noticed that Bran had given him a true order. Until tomorrow, he would have to stay here, in this house, where he'd lived for all these years alone, hiding from his mate's murderer. Tomorrow, then. He calmed himself with the thought. But first he'd repair what he had damaged. Tomorrow he'd help Charles with the rogue, give him anything he could think of that might be useful to him for dealing with an Omega for a mate. And then it would be over. As relief rushed through him, he found it in himself to smile. If Bran wouldn't kill him after yesterday, he was certain that Charles would be happy to oblige. He was calm as he climbed back into his bed, the weight of years lightened by the closeness of their ending. He touched the shirt with his hand and pretended that she was there next to him. Gradually the pain eased, cushioned by his knowledge that it would soon be gone forever and be replaced by peace and darkness. But for now there was only emptiness. He might have slept then, but curiosity, his besetting sin, made him consider the wolf who was killing others so near the Merrock's own territory. Asil sucked in his breath and sat up. So near the Merrock's territory. It killed, looking so much like his dear love. So near the Merrock's territory? Or so near to Asil? And then there were his dreams. His dreams always got stronger when the witch got too close. Sarai hunting humans? He rubbed his eyes. Sarai barely hunted on the full moon nights. Besides, Sarai was dead. Despite the horror of imagining the witch so close, he discovered there was hope in his heart. But he knew that Sarai was dead, just as he knew that Mariposa had somehow stolen the bond between him and his mate. That should have been beyond her, beyond any witch. The wolves kept their magics secret from others. Surely, if one of the families had discovered how to steal the bond between werewolves, they would have done it more than this once, and he would have heard of it by now. It had probably been an accident, a side effect of something else, but in all the years he'd been running, he'd never figured out what. Unless it was the immortality Mariposa seemed to have gained upon Sarai's death. Though he kept it closed as tightly as he could, he still felt the pull of the bond sometimes, as if Mariposa was trying to use it as she had that first day before he realized what was wrong. He thought it was Sarai. He knew that something was wrong, but the distance between them kept him from understanding exactly what. Then he'd woken up in the middle of the night, tears falling from his eyes, though he didn't remember what he was dreaming. He'd reached for his sarai and touched alien madness. He'd run all the rest of the way home, 2 full days, his bond locked down tight so he wouldn't touch that ugliness again. And when he found Sarai dead and the house smelling of magic and Mariposa, he knew what had happened. 2 months later, the witch started to haunt him. He never had figured out exactly what she wanted. He, who had run from nothing, ran from a child not yet into her second decade of life. Because if she took Sarai, he could not guarantee that she could not take him. He was too old, too powerful, to be a tool in the hands of a witch, dead or alive. And his Sarai was dead. He squashed any faint hope lingering in his heart. She was dead, but maybe Mariposa had discovered some way to use the shape of her wolf, an illusion maybe. That sounded right. 3 attacks, and 2x the victim had escaped. Humans don't often escape from werewolf attacks. He was not unfamiliar with black magic. His mate had been an herbalist. It had been she who first taught him how to grow plants indoors. She had sold her herbs to witches until the vendettas between the witch families made it too dangerous. Illusions were among the very basic tenets of witchcraft, making an illusion that could hurt or kill someone. He'd never heard of that. But his suspicion that Mariposa was behind the attacks settled into conviction. All the more reason he find Charles and tell him what he might be facing. Besides, it wasn't in him to allow another person to fight his battles. And if this was Mariposa's mischief, then she was after him. He closed his eyes, but opened them almost immediately. He was making a mountain out of a molehill. Bran referred to the werewolf as he. It was just a rogue. He was letting his own fears color the facts. But it hadn't been a werewolf who sighted the rogue, a small voice argued. Would a pair of humans have noticed if the wolf was female? Female werewolves were not nearly as common. Bran could be assuming it was a male. He hadn't seen the witch for almost 50 years, hadn't caught a scent of her since he'd come to this continent. He'd covered his tracks and asked Bran to keep his presence here quiet. And if she were here and wanted him, why hadn't she just come and gotten him? It wasn't her. He waited for relief to flood him. It was probably not her. Sarai was lost to him. She was 2 centuries dead. He'd buried her himself. He'd never heard of an illusion that could harm people. Maybe the illusion had been the body he'd burned. Rest, Bran had told him, and he felt his body growing sluggish despite the frantic roiling of his mind. He set his seldom-used alarm for 12:01 a.m. Bran might have ordered him to stay here until morning, but Aseel could interpret morning as he chose. And in the morning, he'd go out and find his answers. Anna found herself moving before she had time to think. Mary put out her hand and ended up with a handful of Anna's hair when she tore herself loose to put herself between the human and whatever was in the trees. It sounded to her like a werewolf, but the wind would not cooperate and bring its scent to her. Had the wolf Charles was chasing doubled back? But the monster that emerged from the shadows of the underbrush was bigger than the one Charles was following. It looked almost like a German shepherd, except that it weighed 100 pounds more, had longer teeth, and moved more like a cat than a dog. There were 2 werewolves. What if there were more of them? What if Charles had gone off to hunt one wolf and found himself surrounded? The werewolf ignored the other woman, focusing completely on Anna. As it leaped forward, Anna ran too. The snowshoes didn't help, but she didn't have to go far, and she was a werewolf too. 3 strides, and she snatched Charles's broken rifle off the ground by the barrel, Planting both feet, she swung it at the attacking monster with the experience of 4 summers of softball and the strength of a werewolf. It was clear the other wolf hadn't expected Anna's strength. It hadn't bothered to dodge her strike at all. No one was ever going to fire the rifle again, but Anna hit the wolf full on the shoulder with a crack that told her she'd broken bone. It rolled with the blow, but let out a yip of pain as it came back to all 4 feet. Something sizzled past Anna, and the wolf yelped again as